I'm Samir Patel, editor-in-chief at Quanta Magazine. Our mission at Quanta is to cover what we call basic or fundamental research in science and math. That means the kind of work that's driven by curiosity and discovery and the search for knowledge. We're interested in how and why everything around us works the way that it does. On our brand new show, the Quanta Podcast, you'll meet the writers and editors behind the magazine, and together we'll explore the biggest ideas and the tiniest details. Join me for the Quanta Podcast, your weekly dispatch from the frontiers of science and math.
War in Iran has disrupted oil shipments,
sending ripple effects around the world, from cooking in India.
The biryani might take longer time to cook, so they might cut down on that.
To gas prices in Japan.
It becomes a very visible reminder that the conflict is affecting ordinary life here as well.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, those conversations and how recent bombings in Tehran could affect people's health there for years to come.
Also, a new law in China forces all ethnic groups to speak Mandarin.
Language is like the DNA of a culture. It is key to your ability to identify as a group.
Plus, missing grandma? Then go to Vienna for your granny fix.
Today, here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here. Iran's new Ayatollah Mojtaba Khamenei has issued what Iranian officials are calling his first public statement as supreme leader. He has vowed to, quote, avenge the blood of murders.
They include 165 people who were killed, including many children, when a school in Minab was bombed on the first day of airstrikes. The latest reports find the U.S. responsible for that school bombing, though the attack is still under investigation. Meanwhile, Iran-backed Hezbollah has been using its positions in southern Lebanon to attack Israel, making Beirut and other Lebanese cities targets for the Israeli military. The heavy bombardment has uprooted more than 800,000 Lebanese. Many of those displaced are now sleeping on beaches, in hotels, anywhere they can take shelter from the winter weather and the attacks.
Over the course of this war, the United Nations has condemned its impact repeatedly. The UN has called what's happening in Lebanon a humanitarian crisis and warned that Israeli and U.S. strikes on oil depots in Iran will result in black rain, which has already fallen over Tehran. The conditions are toxic for the some 10 million people living there. We begin today with The World's Shirin Jafari. She's been looking into the impact of fires like these on human health.
It was another sleepless night for many residents of Tehran as fighter jets roared in the sky and dropped bombs on the city. That's been the case for almost 2 weeks now. The bombings are relentless, they say. But as the sun rose this morning, a layer of snow blanketed the city. This woman in Tehran, who doesn't want to be identified, says despite the snow, she can still smell the smoke, gunpowder, and lead. I promise you, this is not AI, says this man, who is filming the huge plume of smoke from a bombing near his home. In the days following the strikes on the fuel depots, people described Tehran as a toxic chamber. They reported burning eyes, difficulty breathing, and skin irritation. The Iranian government hasn't confirmed yet whether the fires have been completely put out. Officials told people to stay home and to close all windows. Doug Weir is the director of the Conflict and Environment Observatory, an NGO based in the UK. He says it's not unusual for oil facilities to be targets during conflicts. That's happened in Ukraine and Sudan, for example.
I think what's been particularly shocking in the case of Tehran is that these sites are usually away from population centres and they are never in the middle of cities of 9 million people.
Tehran's geography also makes the clearing of smoke and toxic particles even more difficult. The city is surrounded by high mountains, giving it the shape of a ball. Tehran is also densely populated with high rises, which makes airflow difficult.
Another factor which we see as well is this question of the boundary layer. And this is kind of when the air pushes pollutants down to street level and down to city level. And it's something which, in the case of Tehran, is something that quite often happens. So we get pollution trapped like a blanket over the city and kind of pushed down during night.
The fires at the fuel depots happened overnight, and that means millions of people who had nowhere else to escape were exposed to intense fumes, he says. The typical pollutants in oil fires include carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, and nitrogen oxide, among other things, Weir adds. This toxic soup is particularly dangerous for those with asthma, the elderly, and children, he says. Even before the war, Tehran was a polluted city. Weir says studies show that people who live in such environments are more vulnerable to high exposure to toxins.
It's quite concerning the degree of pollution which people have been exposed to because of these targetings. And it's something which should have fed into the assessment about the acceptability of these strikes. But it's clear that Israel, you know, was more concerned about destroying these sites than the potential civilian impact.
It's not just the smoke from these fires that people are being exposed to, he says. There's also a mixture of pulverized building material and residue left from the explosive material. There's also a lot of small particles in the atmosphere, and they can end up deep into the lungs. Anna Hansel is a professor of environmental epidemiology at the University of Leicester in the UK. She says there's a body of research that shows long-term impacts of exposure to compounds similar to what's in the fires in Tehran.
For example, in the Gulf War, from veterans who were exposed to what they call burn pits, so they were burning rubbish in an uncontrolled way, a big fire going up, toxic black smoke. And people have been followed up over time from that. So we know that there's an increased risk, not just of cancer of the respiratory tract, but of other organs as well.
Blood cancers, urinary tract cancers, thyroid and prostate cancers are some examples of what has been reported. Hansa says the health impact will depend on the intensity and duration of the exposure to these chemicals. Besides the air, they can enter the waterways and soil and be resuspended into the air weeks, months, or even years later. The key step right now to minimize the impact, she says, is for the bombings to stop.
I think it's really important to try and get some monitoring data on what people are being exposed to and think about doing health studies. And I know it's awfully hard to do those types of studies in a war situation, but people have managed to do those and they can be very valuable, you know, not just immediately, but several years down the line.
This week, the World Health Organization spokesperson Christian Lindemeyer warned about the health risks from the black rain. That's the mixture of rainfall and the toxic material in the air. He said the organization is in touch with the hospitals and the Iranian authorities about the fires at the fuel depots. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
This war has cut off oil to much of the world. Later in the show, we'll hear how people living in three very different places are experiencing that disruption.
There is no singular Chinese language. People from 55 different ethnic groups speak several hundred different languages. And while Mandarin is the official language, the Chinese constitution says each ethnicity has a right to use its own language. But a newly approved law makes Mandarin compulsory in education, government work, and beyond. Ladin Tetong is the director of the Tibetan Action Institute in Boston. She says this new ethnic unity law fits a pattern.
Under Xi Jinping, this is all about forced assimilation of all of the so-called minority groups in the People's Republic of China. And really, it's about ensuring there's no, well, ensuring long-term stability and ensuring there's no resistance to central government rule, because that's what Tibetans and Uyghurs and Southern Mongolians have been engaging in for generations now, is resistance to Beijing's rule.
So assimilation, it's not a new goal of the Chinese government. Authorities have cracked down on ethnic minorities for years and specifically have persecuted the country's Uyghur population for more than a decade. So why was this law passed now?
Yeah, you're right. In practice, there has been, you know, the crackdown under Xi Jinping has been quite intense for, you know, well over a decade now. And this is just codifying it, if you can say that in China today. I feel like they now believe it's okay to do so because there really haven't been any costs for them globally for what they've been doing in practice. So in Tibet, for example, 3 out of every 4 Tibetan children is now coerced, forced into residential boarding schools, and that's as young as age 4. And they are they don't get to learn Tibetan language or learn in their mother tongue. They get Tibetan language taught to them like a second language.
Ledin, you've mentioned at various points Uyghur, Tibetan, Mongolian languages in China. I mean, Mandarin is the main language, as I said in my intro. But what are some of the other languages spoken by the country's 1.4 billion people who will be targets of this law?
Well, I mean, one of the ones that's huge and that people don't quite understand is even Cantonese, right? So the whole of southern China, Hong Kong, I mean, Cantonese is not Mandarin. And even, you know, this, the spoken Cantonese and the rights of Cantonese speakers, you know, to speak and practice, live, go about life using their mother tongue, that's also been targeted. And that, I think, speaks to just how serious and dangerous this Xi Jinping and the his rule is in terms of threatening to, you know, exterminate the unique minority, so-called minority cultures of the PRC. And there are many other sort of smaller languages, ethnic groups, but I think the key for the Chinese government is really the big groups and, you know, the lands that are occupied lands with a distinct and independent history or history of, you know, de facto independence or autonomy. And that obviously is very clear with the Uyghurs, Tibetans, and Southern Mongolians.
So even though this new law is contradictory to China's constitution, you say Xi Jinping is taking this hardline push on assimilation. But why is Beijing focusing on language in this ethnic unity law? Like, what's the overtext?
Well, language is, I mean, it's like the DNA of a culture. It is sort of key to being who you are as a people, how you see the world, and also your ability to identify as a group. It's one of the, you know, it is... If you think of the transmission of mother tongue, right, from the mother to the child, it is it's the first way we learn to live in our world. And for especially a minority group or a group that, you know, is in our case, Tibetans, a population living under military occupation, this is a source of strength. It's a source of community. Critical.
Yeah, take that a step further, if you would, Ladin, because the law makes Mandarin compulsory in very specific contexts, education, government work, and this other nebulous category of public-facing interactions. So I'm guessing like things like menus in restaurants. What is the ultimate goal?
Yeah, the ultimate goal is to make sure that no one speaks that language within a generation or two. And we've seen other nations and empires do this, and that's certainly the intent of the Chinese government. You wouldn't take children away from their parents so young and put them in boarding school. No one does that unless you have some other goals. And in this case, the goals are to alienate them from, separate them from what makes them different and distinct, and then ultimately sever those bonds and the relationship with cultural heritage and this identity that then makes you different. And for Tibetans, certainly, sees the Chinese state as other or separate. And the goal is ultimately turn them into Chinese so they identify with the state and not with their own ancient culture, religion, and they won't be able to speak their own language. That's the idea for all of the so-called ethnic minority groups.
So as this law takes effect, Ladin, what will you be watching for?
Well, I mean, in practice, it's already happening. I think what we'll be watching for is the resistance that will certainly come. And, you know, people think the Chinese state in Xi Jinping, it's just, there's not anything possible there. But actually, you know, Tibetans and Uyghurs and others have defied the odds, Chinese people themselves, time and time again. And I think these laws will certainly foment discontent. And we've had Tibetans inside say, essentially, these laws with even with government officials who Tibetans who work within the system makes them resentful and makes them angry. And the denigration of Tibetan in this way turns even these people who should be friends of the Communist Party, because there's in some way benefiting and a part of the system, turns them against it. And I think that's what we'll be looking for, is the protest and the resistance that's sure to come.
Ladin Tetong is the director of the Tibetan Action Institute in Boston. You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The war in Sudan has been overshadowed in turn by conflicts in Ukraine, then Gaza, and now the wider Middle East. But it rages on, brutally. Since fighting erupted almost 3 years ago between the Sudanese military and a militia called the Rapid Support Forces, it has devastated one of Africa's largest countries. The conflict has deep ties to Gulf nations, and drone warfare has dramatically altered the battlefield. That's according to Nabi Boulos, the Middle East bureau chief for the LA Times. He has just returned from Sudan and gave us a snapshot of the conflict as it currently stands.
The war had initially begun around Khartoum, the capital, and to this day you see so much destruction there. But the center of the conflict has now shifted to an area called Kordofan, which is more in central Sudan. And that's where you're seeing a lot of the attacks happening now with the RSF, you know, the Rapid Support Forces. And they're trying to take over a bunch of cities there with the intention of then using them to stage new offensives against the capital, Khartoum, and eventually Port Sudan. Now, all this is to say that the war is still very much ongoing.
So one of the Sudanese towns you visited is called El Obeid. It is the capital of North Kordofan, which is, as you've said, a contested region. It straddles the front line. The city is held by government forces, but I understand that that hold is quite tenuous. Can you drop us down in that town and tell us what it was like to be there?
The front line is still only about, you know, maybe 50 kilometers away, not even.
Yeah.
And it's quite unstable. So basically, I mean, although there's no active fighting within the city itself, you every day are getting drones. I mean, in many ways, I liken it to sort of like a miniature blitz, I suppose.
Wow. Still,
it was in World War II, you know, in London, where you just sort of sit there at night. And around 3 a.m., you suddenly have just this, like, opening up of machine guns and rocket launchers, right, to try to drop this drone.
By drop, you mean intercept?
Yes, to intercept them, exactly.
And how was that impacting regular folks just trying to live in the city?
Well, as you can imagine, of course, it makes things quite unstable. Now, at the same time, people are getting used to it, which is sad to say, of course, but, you know, I mean, I guess what option do they have? Now, of course, what this means is that you can only travel at certain times of the day, right? You might not be traveling at night, of course, and clearly electricity is going to be, I guess, at a lower level because there have been attacks on energy infrastructure there as well. Of course, education has been also a problem because recently the University of Kordofan, that area was attacked by multiple drones. In fact, I actually went to a lecture hall that had been hit by 3 drones, and that part just seemed like wanton destruction.
Where do these drones that the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, use, where are they coming from?
So there has been a fair amount of documentation that they have been funded by the United Arab Emirates. Now, the United Arab Emirates has consistently denied this and says that it is working towards a peaceful solution in Sudan and that it supports no sides whatsoever. But as I said, there has been quite a lot of documentation saying that the UAE has essentially constructed a resilient pipeline stretching from Libya and all the way to Yemen. And obviously passes through Sudan. And it involves a whole bunch of different countries, whether that's Somalia, Chad, Ethiopia, et cetera. And we're talking about the use of roads, but also bases, ports. And as I said, it's quite a dynamic and resilient pipeline in the sense that when one node falls, another one can take its stead. I mean, all this to say is that the Sudan lies at the center of a whole bunch of networks that involve smuggling in a whole bunch of things, not just drones, but also gold, oil, and other resources.
Yeah, it's striking that we've heard so much about how there is such a need for humanitarian aid in Sudan, and that is hard to get in due to logistics, but can always find a way to get the weapons in, huh?
Well, for sure. But the logistics, I should say, are daunting either way. This pipeline is impressive for the sheer fact that it managed to basically, I mean, surmount the large distances in Sudan. Now, at the same time, yes, for humanitarian aid, it's quite problematic because you also have to contend with the conflict that is going around. So, for example, recently the UN managed to bring in some aid into an area called Kadugli, which is a bit south of where I was. But now that's not possible because there were new attacks on the road.
So speaking of the roads and traveling, you traveled to another town in south central Sudan called Al-Ubayid, which is even closer to militia-held territory, if I'm understanding the map correctly. What was that journey like?
Every trip takes about 2 days just because the distances are so vast and the roads are so bad. So I actually managed to break the control arm of a Toyota Hilux, which I must tell you is not an easy thing to do at all. It's basically a part of the suspension. So basically, if you break it, right, you can't steer the car. And in fact, I broke it in the middle of drone territory. So it was quite harrowing, I suppose. But we managed to get back on the road within 6 hours. So in Ubayid, the idea was we left at about 3 a.m. We arrived at 7 p.m. And, you know, as we sit there that night, right, a whole bunch of drones came in as well. You know, I mean, you're sitting there and then suddenly you're hearing just these machine guns opening up. You hear the SAM missiles rising up to intercept the drone. It's quite harrowing, as you can imagine.
So in the capital, Khartoum, you were able to see up close kind of a way in which this war is being funded in the city's gold market or souk. What is the line between that market that you saw and the war?
There used to be a central gold souk in Khartoum, right? But that building was totally destroyed in the fighting. The gold market has now moved wholesale to one of the few okay parts of town, right? I mean, all these shops that were in this one building are now in this one thoroughfare, and they are all selling gold. The gold actually fuels the war on both sides, right? The RSF has gold mines, but the government also has gold mines, and they are selling the gold to the UAE. The gold goes to the UAE, it's melted there and turned into jewelry that is then sold in the very same stores that sold the gold in the first place. It's quite a strange circle. And the result is, of course, that the money for the war continues to pour in.
Mm. You are now speaking to us back at your home base in Beirut, where things also are far from calm. Is there any way to tell what impact the U.S.-Israel war with Iran is likely to have on the conflict in Sudan? As we have said, there are ties to Gulf countries in this conflict.
I mean, there is potential that this new war between the U.S. and Iran is going to actually push, I suppose, Saudi Arabia and the UAE maybe closer. And so they'll start maybe working towards a solution of the war in Sudan. Although at the same time, I mean, I would argue that's unlikely.
Why not?
Well, because, I mean, the fact is their goals are very different. The UAE sees in Sudan an Islamist bastion, and Saudi Arabia cares about the stability of the country as it is, right? And so, yeah, it's actually unclear to me if they can actually manage to, have a bit of rapprochement. I can't see that happening. But at the same time, who knows? Things are changing.
We've talked about the striking ways that things are bad in Sudan. You have described them well. What can also be striking in periods of conflict or catastrophe is how people step up to help one another. Did you see any examples of that?
I mean, there have been various efforts of doing so, right? You, of course, have a very powerful doctor syndicate that has tried to help people. You have various initiatives. But the fact is that, I mean, it should be said, just the needs are so vast, right? I mean, I have seen, of course, instances of people doing great work documenting what's happening, of people who have been continuing to come back to work despite everything. I mean, even in the National Museum, people are even now cataloging all the stuff that was lost, trying to recover everything that was looted. So you see these pockets of effort to make things better. At the same time, I mean, the situation is just simply so dire that it would take much more than those efforts. It needs, I suppose, true will, right, on the part of national governments to try to push this war to an end.
Nabi Boulos is the Middle East Bureau Chief for the LA Times. He has just returned from Sudan. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We know that oil shortages are shocking markets, but what does that actually look like on the ground across the globe? Three people in three places weigh in. That's coming up. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Let's talk now about oil.
Prices have remained stubbornly high even after 32 countries agreed yesterday to release a whopping 400 million barrels of oil from their emergency reserves. That move was coordinated by the International Energy Agency. It will be the biggest release from emergency oil reserves in history, more than double what was announced after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022.
It is meant to alleviate high oil prices and oil shortages brought on by the effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz, a key passageway for oil and gas from the Persian Gulf. The sudden cutoff to global markets has disrupted daily life and commercial operations in all kinds of ways.
This wide-ranging impact is what we're going to look at now, zooming in on three different places: India, Japan, and South Africa. We begin with India. Ruchita Shah is an energy analyst with the energy think tank Ember. When we reached her in New Delhi earlier today, she explained that people in India use cylinders of fuel to run their stoves for cooking. For that, they rely on liquefied petroleum gas, or LPG, which, because of the war in Iran, is not flowing in like it used to.
And that led to a panic situation initially. For example, cooking gas is crucial for domestic usage, but at the same time for all the commercial purposes such as restaurants. And government started prioritizing the domestic supply of LPG cylinders, but the commercial side of it got hit. For example, I would want to quote from restaurants which started talking about, we have 2 to 4 days of supply available only. So we will cut down our menus. The cost of food might go up. At the same time, the schools, which also provide meals to students, many schools do that. And they have started saying that we will not be able to supply or provide lunch for the students.
So the liquefied petroleum gas component of this is really important in the Indian context. I mean, you mentioned cutting down on menus. What does this look like at homes and schools and restaurants when it comes to what is actually served on a plate?
So right now, I would say there is a very evident or stark difference what is happening, say, in an urban city setup and a rural area. So urban or city setup is largely dependent on LPG cylinders or piped gas. So the difference or the impact is very much visible. Whereas in rural India, people still go back to using firewood as a fuel supply, which is not the best form of fuel supply because it does a lot of air pollution as well as impacts the health of the person who's cooking. But in urban area, for example, induction cooktop, which is run by electricity, the demand has increased because traditional Indian cooking right now is not very well supported with electric induction cooktops. It is more like gas-based, flame-based cooking style. So at the moment, whatever cooking requires lesser gas would be preferred. For example, biryani, it might take longer time to cook, so they might cut down on that.
Interesting.
Which gets cooked quickly will become a go-to option because it will use lesser amount of gas.
I was going to ask you, I mean, with this big dependency in India on LPG, what is the conversation like right now around the impact on oil from the war in Iran? What are you hearing?
So there is no announcement for change in oil prices at the moment. I do not see people panicking immediately. And government is also sending messages that they have diversified and they are trying to procure from all the other sources available. So the procurement strategy is being built around how to just to keep everyone like confident that, okay, there will be no shortage. And anyway, 74 days takes you to like 2 months. And by that time, the diversification will lead to enough oil sources, hopefully. But it's just that the gas production was very much dependent on sourcing from the Middle East. So that was becoming a challenge.
So, Ruchita, you said that India has a reserve of almost 2 months of oil. What is the contingency, though, if the shortages continue and prices spike beyond that?
One number that I would like to quote here is 70% import are coming from other routes at the moment, comparing to what 55% was earlier. So they're trying to diversify their sources of procurement of crude oil at the moment.
I know Prime Minister Modi has made the expansion of the electric grid a national priority. Are you worried that the efforts in India to shift to renewables will be compromised?
No, I think this situation actually strengthens and actually pushes us forward. For example, the states which have more electric vehicle running at the moment, will be less scared of petrol and diesel shortages versus the states which are largely dependent on petrol and diesel-run vehicles.
So you think this oil crisis could actually be beneficial for the transition to renewables in some sectors?
Definitely. So this brings us to the situation where we keep saying that we want to become self-reliant, we want to become energy secure. We would want to become secure as possible so that the economy doesn't come to a standstill or the day-to-day life doesn't get impacted the way it got impacted at the moment.
Ruchita Shah is an energy analyst with the energy think tank Ember. She spoke with us from New Delhi.
So India has been seeing panic about the ability to cook and eat. In Japan, the picture is a little different. A whopping 90% of Japan's oil comes through the Strait of Hormuz. Daisuke Kawai is director of the Economic Security and Policy Innovation Program at the University of Tokyo. When I asked him how serious the impact of this blockade has been there, he did not mince words.
It's quite a significant problem for Japan. Japan's actually energy security, so I would say Japan's response has been very swift and pragmatic. The government has decided to release oil from both private sector and the state level, and beginning with 15 days of worth of private reserves, and then about 1 month of national reserves from late March as part of the wider International Energy Agency's coordinated release. So it is also capping gasoline prices at roughly 170 yen per liter through subsidies, and has said it is ready to take additional physical measures.
So you said that the government has already announced a cap on gas prices in some cities.
Yes.
So is this already impacting people on the ground there? I mean, has gas shot up already to some extent?
It hasn't been affected yet, I would say.
Gas prices specifically?
Yeah, gas and oil prices. So Japan is actually better prepared than many people assume, I would say, but according to Japanese government, Japan's own official explanation as well, it holds the oil reserve equivalent to about 254 days of consumption and import cover in total.
That's a significant cushion. It could survive for almost a year if oil is cut off entirely.
Indeed.
So when will Japan start feeling this impact despite its big reserves?
That's a good question. As we discussed, the Strait of Hormuz is one of the world's most important energy choke points for us. So I would say if it continues to have a kind of same situation for another month, I think Japanese people feel serious challenges.
You've mentioned the government responses. How is the public responding? You say there is worry.
Yeah, so what I can say from daily life in Japan is that people are starting to notice it. Everyone is more cautious of gasoline prices. And once the national average moves up above around 160 yen per liter.
That's around $4 a gallon.
Yeah, yeah. It becomes a very visible reminder that the conflict is affecting ordinary life here as well.
I know that you have a car. Have you been to the gas pump since this conflict started?
Yes. So you can see the rise of oil prices in Tokyo particularly. So some gasoline stand shows the price, which is almost a double price of the normal days. So
double price for gas already.
Yeah.
And so have you filled up or have you been trying to wait?
You know, I try to go to local area to find a cheaper gasoline stand.
How long did you have to drive around to find that cheaper gas?
I would say 40 minutes, yeah.
Oh, wow. Are people starting to stock up on anything, stock up on fuel or panic buying anything else?
No, no, not at all. There's no panic buying, yeah. We have a kind of a lessons learned, such as a tsunami incident. During that time, we had a big earthquake, but many people try to stay calm, no panic buying, try to listen to governmental guidance. So that's one of the strengths that Japanese people may have.
Daisuke Kawai is director of the Economic Security and Policy Innovation Program at the University of Tokyo.
One last spot for us to check out today with this looming oil crisis. For that, we go to Nick Headley in Johannesburg. He's an energy researcher and told me about the impact in South Africa and in other African countries.
We are already seeing fears of fuel shortages in South Africa as well. I think it's maybe a little extreme and too soon to be worrying about fuel shortages just yet, but we are bracing for some pretty big fuel price increases. So in South Africa, where our fuel prices are regulated, they are increased or decreased once a month, adjusted once a month. And the upcoming change is a nearly 20% increase overnight, which is going to have pretty substantial effects throughout the economy. So the second sort of side order effect of that is to strengthen the value of local currencies, which have been sold off as investors flee to safe haven assets like the US dollar. Central banks are probably going to have to increase interest rates as well. So it's kind of a double whammy, high inflation and higher interest rates on the horizon.
You're based in South Africa, Nick, and you're kind of talking at an economic level. But what is this scuttlebutt on the street about how things could worsen at this point and the impact on all those daily needs you just mentioned?
We are facing a very difficult kind of economic crisis ahead, as is much of the world. For the average person, it will be felt through much higher food prices, which is a big share of people's disposable income in a lot of Africa. So people spend a much higher share of their salaries and disposable income on food and transport in this part of the world than they do in the US. So when prices for food and travel go up, that's really a big hit.
I'm curious, where does South Africa get most of its oil?
We don't have local crude oil production, but we do have, and this is actually an old apartheid era, strange kind of quirk. In the apartheid days when we had sanctions on South Africa and we struggled to import oil, we developed industries that convert coal into fuel. Mm. It's exceptionally dirty and very environmentally damaging, but we do produce fuel through coal. So we partly shielded from that, partly shielded from getting about 2/3 of our oil from West Africa. But regardless, prices are climbing very fast.
Oil from West Africa, like Nigeria, possibly Angola as well.
Correct, exactly.
Those countries like Nigeria and Angola, are their oil contracts immutable? I mean, is there any way the Nigerian or the Angolan governments can impose on oil companies to hold back some of the supply?
So there's a kind of interesting dynamic in Nigeria. This is not directly answering your question. It's something that I've seen recently is there's basically just a single monopoly, extremely large oil refinery in Nigeria that supplies now pretty much all of Nigeria's needs for fuel. And because it's a monopoly and it's kind of wrangled the government into halting imports of fuel products, it has total control over the market. So kind of taking advantage of this period of very inflated prices to raise domestic prices. So even in countries where there is local production, local crude oil extraction and refinery, prices are climbing very fast. And it may be a need for governments to kind of step in where possible to neutralize things.
Nick, this is not the first war that has cost the African continent in terms of energy imports. Are there any examples of lessons taken from the impact of the war in Ukraine, which also had impact?
Yeah. So a direct one from Russia-Ukraine was as oil prices spiked, Ethiopia's import bill really skyrocketed. And in direct response to that, Ethiopia banned imports of combustion engine vehicles and has basically kind of had an EV mandate. And it's curbed their reliance on imported oil, which has shielded them a lot in this current crisis. And I think it's a lesson for the rest of the continent in this new crisis we're in.
Nick Headley is an energy researcher based in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Two different sounds, West African percussion and Celtic fiddles and flutes. It is a musical combination that sounds like it could feel contrived, but in practice it works pretty well. Minnesota Public Radio's Jacob Aloy has more on the Twin Cities group behind the mashup.
The idea to combine West African percussion and Celtic instruments started when musician Sean Egan was at a performance of West African music and dance many years ago.
It struck me that those rhythms would be very compatible with the rhythms of Irish dance music.
That thought led him to create Conakry, spelled C-A-N-A-D-H-C-R-O-I.
When assembling the group, Egan reached out to fellow Celtic musicians. And after some internet sleuthing and a recommendation from a neighbor, he also connected with some West African percussionists. One of them is Fodi Bangura, who was originally from Guinea.
So the Africa culture, this is not just Guinea. The whole Africa continent, you know, it's a battle. You know, how do people unite the other people together? So the drumming and dance, it bring everybody together. It's very community, it's very powerful, you know, spiritually, everything.
Conakry's spiritual power can now be heard by people outside of Minnesota. The group released its first album, Badania, earlier this year. Funded by a state arts grant, the album boasts strong beats from instruments like the djembe, a hand drum, and melodies from the flute and fiddle give it a light feeling. Plus, there's a great deep quality that's added by Egan's clarinet and bass clarinet.
It's definitely not, like, part of the tradition.
That's Danny Diamond, the group's fiddler, commenting on the clarinet.
But it works really well. The instrument is just so beautiful. It's so rich and it fills space so nicely, but it can still carry a melody.
While there are challenges to making the two distinct musical traditions work, there is also a commonality, as both are folk music. And historically speaking, Ireland and West Africa are both regions that have suffered under colonialism. Diamond, who is from Ireland, shares that his family had to leave Belfast during the conflict known as the Troubles.
Colonialism has impacted and in music, but it's impacted on me personally within an Irish context. Like, Guinea has it much harder than Ireland. It would be bogus to try to frame it as exactly equivalent, but it hits really hard at the moment because of the context of Minnesota. The project was like abstract and fun and like quirky 6 months ago, but it's been brought to a point where I feel like it's really vital and meaningful by the circumstances around us.
The beauty of Conakry's music is in its ability to have two cultures speak to one another in a musical language. That theme is captured in the group's name. Once again, founder Sean Egan.
Conakry is the capital city of Guinea, and two of our drummers are from Conakry. But in the Irish language, Conakry is an expression which roughly translates to singing of the heart.
Rattle and roar and Willie O'Hee held to the fair for to sell his fiddle and buy some motherware. But parting with his fiddle, the psalter blint is he. Rattle and roar and Willie, you're welcome home to me. Willie, come sell your fiddle, come sell your fiddle. So
for the world, Willie, I'm Jacob Alloy in St. Paul.
If I should sell me fiddle, the world would think I was mad. Many's a rant and day me fiddle that I have had.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Vienna's ornate coffee houses are an institution, but one coffee shop in the Austrian capital is different from its grand neighbors. For starters, many of its workers are well over 65, and the cakes they bake come from their own family recipes. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports from Vienna.
The first thing that hits you when you walk through the doors of Full Pension coffee shop is the smell. A warm chocolate cake has just come out of the oven, and one of the bakers is placing it carefully on a wire tray next to a selection of other freshly baked goods.
We have banana cakes, we have some lemon cakes, the pavlovas are in oven. The cheesecake is hot now.
Elizabeth is from Poland. She's just 68, she tells me. Just because she's one of the younger staff members here.
My name is Marianne Hoffmann. I'm 81 years old.
81-year-old Mariana has been working in the cafe for more than 10 years. She used to work in a law office, she says, but at the age of 69, she decided it was time to retire. A year later, bored and a little lonely, she says, she spotted an article about a coffee shop looking for grandmas and grandpas to bake cakes and chat with customers. And she decided to check it out. Mariana doesn't actually bake, though.
When I was young and with my children, I've every cooked and baked, and now it's not mine. You've had enough of baking. But enough of baking and cooking all your life.
I don't like to cook for me alone. It's so bleh. Not good.
So rather than cook, her job is to chat to the customers. The coffee shop is the brainchild of Moritz Piffel Perchevich. He's one of the cafe's co-founders. And the idea came to him, he says, almost 15 years ago.
A friend of mine and me, we went for a coffee in one of our favorite coffee shops in Vienna. And he ordered a piece of cake. And then he had it and I tried it. And then we said, oh, well, it's not that good, actually. And then we ended up having a conversation. Why cake is always so much better from your auntie, your ma, or your grandmother.
Piffel Perchevich decided to try opening a pop-up cafe where actual grandmothers and grandfathers would bake their own cakes. And it was a huge hit. So in 2015, he opened the doors of Full Pension Cafe. Full Pension can mean two things in German: full board or retirement. Piffel Perchevich says he wanted the cafe to be a place where different generations, the young and the retired, could meet and talk.
When I left home, went to another city, I ended up spending most of the time with people of my age. And when the idea of Full Pension evolved, I was at the point in life where I already had realized that I was missing this living under one roof with three different generations.
81-year-old Mariana goes to talk to a family who've just sat down with a plate of warm walnut brownies.
We come from Germany.
Southwestern Park. So Upper Rhine Valley, we are living definitely in the Black Forest, or the very end of the Black Forest.
Klaus, from Germany, says he's in Vienna for work. His wife and daughter have joined him for a short visit. A friend of theirs who lives in Vienna recommended the cafe, he says. Klaus says it reminds him of his own grandmother's house.
It's a very lovely atmosphere, very heartful. It's the kitchen like at home, grandmother's home. So it's a little bit of feeling very, very tiny again. It's like a children's feeling because they're real grandmothers.
Klaus is sitting on a colourful, slightly lumpy armchair. Most of the furniture is second-hand and mismatched. And the exposed brick walls are covered with old photos, lots of pictures of dogs, and some kitsch tapestries. There are some men working here, but Piffel Perchevich, the co-founder, says there's a reason why so many of the older staff members are women.
We do have a tremendous pension pay gap in Austria, so the female pensions are a lot smaller than male pensions. And if you are retired woman living alone, don't own a home, then money can be very short.
The coffee shop lets some of the workers have a social life again, he says.
What I did not know before we started is that financial poverty is the number one driver for social poverty. So once you cannot afford to go to the movies or to the theater or to go to a restaurant, it's very hard to meet new people.
Elizabeth, the Polish baker, says she started working here partly because her husband could never finish off all the cake she baked at home. And also, she really likes the company.
You know, you live home, so you go out and you have social contacts. Nearly the same important as baking, to meet another people, just go out from home.
I asked 81-year-old Mariana how long she thinks she'll keep working here.
I don't know, I hope. I cannot say.
The contract is minimum for another 10 years, Marianne. Yeah. So
I don't know. I'm healthy and I'm so grateful. Yeah. I can do this and this I'm happy every day.
As I leave, Elizabeth gives me a small cardboard box. Inside is a large slice of creamy carrot cake. It's one for the road, she says. For the World, I'm Orla Barry, Vienna.
Before we let you go today, some old sounds on a new compilation of music from an influential band from Zimbabwe. In the 1980s, Zigzag Band was huge there. Zimbabwe.
Zigzag Band came to define chiguillo music, a style unique to Zimbabwe. It mixes reggae, guitar lines inspired by the traditional thumb piano, the mbira, brass arrangements, and electronic dance beats.
The lyrics are in the language spoken by the largest ethnic group in Zimbabwe, the Shona. Throughout the 80s and into the 90s, Zigzag Band was a household name in Zimbabwe. Their goal was never a big commercial pop sound or global fame. They were committed to the style of music they helped create.
Chiguillo music was replaced by other sounds as Zigzag Band slowly broke apart, with its players dying in the 90s and early 2000s. This new compilation celebrates the underappreciated musical legacy the group left behind. We leave you with a tune from Zigzag Band, Chiguillo Music Kings 1987 to 1998. It's called Mangangai, or in English, Glittering.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Piggott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.